The call came in just after sunrise in March 2023. A neighbor at a crowded apartment complex in Nevada reported shouting in the walkway, then a sudden silence that felt wrong. When officers arrived, they found 34-year-old Thomas Hughes on the concrete near the stairwell. He was still conscious for a moment, trying to speak, while residents stood back in fear and confusion. The suspect, a man who lived only a few doors away, stayed inside his apartment and waited for police. He later claimed the stabbing happened during a sudden argument. Several neighbors insisted they heard more than a simple dispute. Their accounts did not match each other, and early details only deepened the uncertainty. Nothing about the scene explained why a long-running tension between two neighbors turned fatal. Detectives needed to know what happened in the minutes before Thomas fell, and whether the truth was already buried under conflicting stories. Chapter 1, The Last Night. The call reached the local dispatch center just after 7:23 p.m. on a cool March night in Nevada. The dispatcher heard panic in the caller's voice. The woman said there had been a loud argument in the walkway of her apartment complex, followed by a thud that made her step backward from her own door. She said a man was on the ground near the stairwell. She sounded unsure if he was breathing. Sirens were sent to the address within seconds. It was the kind of call that carried more fear than fact. Nothing about the early details told the dispatcher exactly what had happened, only that something had gone very wrong. Two patrol cars arrived at the complex within minutes. Officers stepped out and heard the uneasy quiet that often settles in after violence. A few residents had crept outside. They stood near the railing or behind cracked doors. Their voices stayed low. Several pointed toward the walkway that connected the first row of apartments. The officers followed their gestures and found 34-year-old Thomas Hughes lying on the concrete beside the stairwell. He was conscious for a brief moment. He tried to speak, but could not form words. His hands trembled as he attempted to steady himself. One officer crouched beside him, speaking calmly, asking him to stay awake. An ambulance was already en route. The walkway lights cast a pale glow over the scene. The railings, the chipped paint on the walls, and the doors lined in identical rows all looked the same as they had the day before. But the presence of so many neighbors watching in fear changed the atmosphere. The officers ordered everyone to stand back. They moved quickly to secure the space until paramedics arrived. One resident asked if Thomas would be all right. The officer gave no answer. He did not know enough yet to offer one. The first paramedic team reached the walkway and assessed Thomas. They moved him onto a gurney with practiced precision. Their faces gave nothing away. Professional calm had taken over. They asked residents to step aside as they rolled him toward the parking lot where the ambulance waited. The scene grew quieter as the paramedics worked. By the time the gurney disappeared from sight, one officer had already begun marking off the stairwell area with tape. Another officer walked toward the unit where the suspect lived. Several residents pointed toward the same door. A few said he had stepped back inside moments after the argument. The officer knocked and announced himself. There was a short delay before the suspect opened the door. His face held a stillness that seemed out of place for the moment. He told officers he was the one who had called for help after seeing Thomas fall. He said the argument had escalated. He also said he had acted in self-defense. The officer asked him to step outside, and he complied. He kept his hands visible and remained calm. More officers arrived, and the first steps of securing the building took shape. Residents were asked to remain available for statements. Some waited near their doors. Others gathered in small groups on the far end of the walkway. They offered fragments of what they heard. A man said the argument sounded sharp but short. A woman said she heard footsteps moving quickly. Another said she had heard a voice that sounded afraid. None felt certain about the full sequence of events. As officers moved through the walkway, they placed evidence markers where needed. They noted the position of the stairwell, the suspect's door, and the nearest unit where a resident reported hearing raised voices. The layout of the walkway mattered. It was narrow, with metal railings on one side and apartment doors on the other. The stairwell formed a blind corner that separated the walkway from the parking lot below. The walls carried sound easily. Conversations, arguments, and even televisions often drifted from one end of the building to the other. Detective Laura Benton arrived shortly after the ambulance pulled away. She walked the length of the walkway, taking in the scene. She saw nervous faces and tense shoulders. She saw apartment doors left ajar. She saw residents holding their phones, unsure if they should record or stay silent. Most kept their distance, but all wanted to know what had happened. Benton stopped near the stairwell where Thomas had been found. She crouched and studied the immediate surroundings. The corner where he fell created a space that was partially shielded from one camera, but visible from another angle. She noted the absence of items that might indicate a struggle in the walkway. There were no overturned trash bins, no scattered belongings, and no signs of a physical chase. The scene looked undisturbed aside from the medical intervention. A uniformed officer briefed her on the early information. He explained that several residents reported hearing an argument between Thomas and the suspect. He said the suspect admitted to being involved and claimed he had been defending himself. He also said that no residents reported seeing the confrontation directly. Each account so far came from sound and assumption rather than sight. Benton asked to see the suspect. Officers escorted him downstairs to an open area near the parking lot. He stood with his hands near his waist, not restrained but closely monitored. His breathing was steady. His eyes stayed fixed on the ground when Benton approached. She introduced herself and asked him to explain what happened. He repeated what he told officers earlier. He said Thomas came to his door angry about a noise issue. He said Thomas stepped toward him in a threatening way. He said he feared being harmed and acted quickly. Benton listened without interrupting. When he finished, she asked if Thomas had been armed. The suspect said he did not see a weapon. Benton asked if the argument happened inside his apartment or outside. He said it happened at the doorway. The suspect's answers were short. They left gaps that Benton knew would need a detailed interview later. For now, she asked officers to keep him available while they continued the scene assessment. Residents began giving their formal statements. One woman said she heard two sets of footsteps, followed by shouting that rose and fell suddenly. She described the argument as sharp but not long. She said she did not open her door because she feared getting caught in the middle of something unpredictable. A man who had been watching television said he muted his screen when the noise outside grew louder. He said he heard a voice that sounded startled, then silence. He opened his door and saw neighbors gathering. He insisted he did not see the moment of the confrontation. Another resident, who lived two doors down from Thomas, offered a different detail. She said she had heard tensions between Thomas and the suspect before. She said their arguments were not frequent, but noticeable. They involved raised voices about everyday frustrations, mostly about noise in the building. None escalated to violence until that night. Detectives marked each apartment door mentioned in the statements. They documented where residents stood when they heard the argument. They measured the distances from those doors to the suspect's unit. Benton walked the walkway several times, noting angles where residents would have had obstructed views. She considered which walls carried sound more clearly. She paid attention to how voices echoed when officers spoke. She knew that the physical environment shaped memory, and she wanted to understand the setting as completely as possible. As the evening grew darker, crime scene technicians wrapped up their initial work. They had photographed the walkway, the stairwell, the suspect's apartment door, and the surrounding area. They had placed markers for each item collected. They had taken samples from surfaces near the doorway and along the walkway. They had sealed the knife recovered from the suspect's kitchen in evidence bags. Benton reminded them to log the items carefully. The weight of the case depended on precision. Officers escorted the suspect to a patrol car for transport to the station. He agreed to provide a recorded statement. He asked if Thomas was alive. No one answered. They did not yet know. The ambulance had left for the nearest medical center minutes earlier. Updates would come later, after the emergency team completed their assessment. As Benton continued her walkthrough, she reflected on the nature of the setting. Crowded apartment complexes often held long histories of small disputes. Noise complaints, hallway arguments, and tension over shared walls were common. She knew that many confrontations started with simple misunderstandings. Thin walls created assumptions. A loud voice behind a door might sound like aggression when it was only frustration. A knock might feel like a threat when it was only impatience. The challenge in cases like these was separating perception from fact. She spoke briefly with a maintenance worker who had come to check on the building. He said the complex had dealt with noise issues for months. He said complaints rose whenever new tenants moved in. He said the walls were thin enough that residents sometimes blamed the wrong unit for sound. He also said Thomas had never caused major trouble, at least from his perspective. He said the suspect kept to himself, but sometimes argued with people on the phone. None of his comments provided answers, but they offered context. Benton finished taking notes at the stairwell and stepped back to observe the walkway as a whole. She imagined the moments before the call. Thomas walking toward the suspect's door. The argument beginning. Residents hearing fragments through their walls. The sudden shift that caused someone to pick up the phone and dial for help. In the calm after the incident, the walkway looked ordinary. Yet it had held a fatal confrontation only an hour earlier. Back at the station, detectives began assembling the early case file. They logged the statements from residents, the suspect's initial account, and the preliminary findings from the scene. They created a timeline based on the 911 call and the estimated time of the argument. They included details from patrol officers who arrived first. They noted that Thomas had been conscious briefly at the scene, but had difficulty speaking. The medical center called shortly before 9 p.m. to confirm that Thomas had not survived. The news reached Detective Benton while she sat at the station reviewing her notes. She closed her notebook for a moment. The weight of the case shifted. It no longer involved a serious injury. It was now a homicide. The officers at the station paused when they heard. Some lowered their heads. Others sat back quietly. It changed the urgency of the next steps. Benton called her supervisor. She explained the new status. He instructed her to proceed with collecting every detail from the suspect as quickly as possible. They needed clarity on the sequence of events before the night grew any later. The suspect sat alone in an interview room. He did not ask for a lawyer. He did not ask for water. He kept his hands folded and stared at the tabletop. Benton entered the room with another detective. She introduced herself again and explained that the interview would be recorded. The suspect nodded. His posture remained calm. She asked him to walk through the events of the evening. He said Thomas came to his door angry about noise from the night before. He said Thomas accused him of disturbing the building. He said he told Thomas to calm down. He said Thomas stepped forward with a raised voice. He said he grabbed a knife from the kitchen because he felt unsafe. He said the encounter moved fast. He said he acted to protect himself. Benton asked him to explain the distance between the kitchen and the doorway. He hesitated. She noted the hesitation. She asked if he believed Thomas intended to harm him. He said yes. She asked why. He said Thomas had been angry before. He said he feared the situation would get out of control. His voice stayed steady throughout the interview. He did not raise it. He did not lower it. When the interview ended, detectives escorted him to a holding area. They would decide on next steps after reviewing the full case file. For now, they needed additional evidence. They needed the lab results. They needed to study the camera footage. They needed to speak to more residents. The night had given them the first outline of the incident, but it did not give them answers. Back at the apartment complex, the yellow tape remained in place. Residents inside the building locked their doors earlier than usual. Some kept lights on. Others peered through blinds, uneasy about the silence in the walkway. The stairwell where Thomas had fallen held a presence that was hard to ignore. What had been an ordinary corner of the building only hours earlier now felt marked by fear and confusion. Detective Benton returned to the scene once more before the night ended. She walked the walkway alone, letting the quiet settle. She knew the coming days would bring more interviews, more evidence, and more uncertainty. She also knew that the first night told an important story. It carried the raw fear, the confusion, and the urgency that often disappeared in later reporting. It held the voices of residents who had not yet been influenced by conversations or worry. It held the first statements, the first emotions, and the first details that shaped the direction of the investigation. As she stood near the stairwell, she reflected on the most pressing question. What had happened in the minutes before Thomas fell? Without clarity on those moments, the investigation would remain incomplete. She looked down the walkway toward the suspect's door. The distance between the two doors felt shorter than she expected. It reminded her how quickly tension could rise in a crowded building where boundaries felt thin. The night ended with more questions than answers. Detectives gathered their notes, secured the evidence, and prepared for what the next day would bring. The first chapter of the case was now set. It recorded the moment the call came in, the first response, the witness statements, and the early claims of self-defense. What remained unknown would unfold in the chapters that followed. Chapter 2, Conflicting Stories. Detectives returned to the apartment complex the morning after the stabbing. The building felt heavier than usual, as if the noise of the day could not push past what had happened the night before. Residents came and went with lowered voices. Some carried bags to their cars, stepping around the walkway where Thomas Hughes had last been seen alive. The yellow tape still hung across the stairwell. It marked the boundaries of the scene, but it also marked the emotional line the complex had crossed. People no longer assumed safety in the space between their doors. Inside the temporary command room set up on the ground floor, Detective Laura Benton reviewed what they had so far. Officers had collected Thomas's clothing, the suspect's shirt, the knife recovered from the suspect's kitchen sink, and the first round of neighbor statements. None of it formed a clean picture. Every detail depended on who had been listening through the walls and who had been brave enough to open a door. Benton asked for Thomas's background file. She wanted to understand the man at the center of the case before she moved deeper into the timeline. The file showed that Thomas worked shifts at a local distribution center. He had lived in the complex a little over 2 years. There were two prior complaints filed in his name. One involved a noise dispute over loud music on a Saturday night. The other was a short written report about a disagreement in the parking lot involving a different neighbor. Both incidents were minor. According to management, he paid on time, kept his unit clean, and never caused significant trouble. The suspect's file sat beside it. He had moved into the building less than a year earlier. He worked irregular hours and kept to himself based on the management's description. There were three building-level complaints tied to his unit. All three involved shouting or loud arguments. None rose to the level of police intervention. There was no documented history between him and Thomas beyond the noise issues that had become common in the complex. Detectives started the day by re-interviewing residents. The first neighbor, a woman who lived across the walkway, said she heard two men talking in raised voices. She did not see the moment of the stabbing, but she heard a sharp shift in tone. After that, she heard movement that reminded her of someone stumbling. She could not say who struck first. She could not confirm if the suspect's claim of self-defense matched what she heard. She said only that she heard fear in one of the voices. Another neighbor described hearing a single loud argument, followed by what he believed was a struggle. He said he heard a man say "stop" in a strained voice. He did not know if it was Thomas. He also admitted he turned off his lights and stayed still when things intensified. He did not open his door. He said he felt guilty, but he had children inside, and he did not want them exposed to danger. A third neighbor, an older man who lived alone, offered a different version. He said he heard nothing until he stepped outside to take his trash out. When he opened his door, he saw Thomas leaning forward on the walkway with blood on his clothing. He could not see the suspect. He could not confirm whether the argument started inside or outside. According to him, everything seemed to happen in seconds. His view was blocked by the corner of the building. These statements left detectives with a problem. Each witness believed what they heard, but no two statements aligned cleanly. The only consistency was that the dispute escalated quickly and that no one had a full view. Detectives moved to the next part of the investigation. The apartment complex camera system had several hallway views, but each camera covered only part of a walkway. the stairwell where Thomas collapsed sat in a blind spot. The footage did not show the stabbing itself. Instead, it showed Thomas walking toward the suspect's door at 7:21 p.m. The timestamp from the hall camera had been verified. Just over a minute later, the camera picked up sudden movement, but only shadows. The angle made it impossible to see the full confrontation. By 7:23 p.m., neighbors were opening doors in response to the noise. Detective Benton paused the footage several times. She watched the frames where Thomas moved toward the door. His walk looked steady. His hands stayed visible. The footage did not show him entering the suspect's apartment or forcing his way inside. It only showed him approaching. The footage did not show the suspect until the moment after the incident, when he retreated back into his apartment. Detectives then reviewed the first lab returns. The knife collected from the suspect's kitchen sink had Thomas's blood on the blade. It also had partial prints belonging to the suspect. These findings confirmed the weapon's role, but they did not answer why or how the confrontation escalated. The suspect's shirt had no visible tears, but had blood transfer on the front. Lab results showed that blood belonged to Thomas. The suspect claimed he was attacked first and defended himself. Detectives knew the pattern of blood on clothing could support or conflict with that statement, but they needed full analysis before drawing conclusions. Later that afternoon, detectives conducted a recorded interview with the suspect. He sat across from them with a quiet expression. His hands stayed tight together. His voice did not rise or fall. He said he had been inside his apartment when he heard knocking. He opened the door and saw Thomas, who he claimed was angry about noise from the night before. According to the suspect, Thomas stepped forward in a threatening way. The suspect said he grabbed a knife because he feared being attacked. He said everything happened fast. He said he acted to protect himself. Detective Benton listened closely. The account lacked detail. The suspect did not describe seeing a weapon. He did not describe any physical contact before the stabbing. He said he believed Thomas was going to hurt him, but he did not provide evidence for that belief. The detectives reminded him that neighbors heard the argument in the walkway. The suspect paused and said he did not remember shouting. He repeated only that he acted out of fear. When detectives compared his interview with the witness statements, they saw the gaps. No neighbor reported hearing Thomas threaten the suspect. No witness saw Thomas enter the suspect's apartment or attempt to force his way in. At the same time, no witness saw the full confrontation. Without a clear line of sight, detectives could not rely solely on what residents believed they heard. Detectives then turned to reconstructing the timeline using all available data. The 911 call from the first reporting neighbor came in at 7:23 p.m. The hall camera showed Thomas approaching the suspect's door at 7:21 p.m. The gap between those moments was 2 minutes. The suspect said the argument lasted longer, but the timestamps disagreed with his estimate. The timeline suggested a brief conflict rather than a prolonged fight. Detectives created a minute-by-minute breakdown. 7:21 p.m., Thomas walks toward the suspect's door. 7:21, 30 seconds. Shadows move in front of the camera but remain unclear. 7:22 p.m., a sudden interruption in the audio track appears. It likely came from something striking the walkway wall. 7:22, 30 seconds. A neighbor opens a door, responding to the disturbance. 7:23 p.m., the 911 call begins. The caller reports a man down. This reconstruction confirmed the speed of the event. Detectives noted that self-defense claims typically involve a clear threat or a sustained conflict. The brief window raised questions. It did not prove anything on its own, but it shaped the direction of the investigation. Detectives then reviewed building records. Earlier that day, there had been a brief argument between Thomas and the suspect in the parking lot. It lasted less than a minute. A resident had overheard raised voices, but did not report it. Management had no record of the incident. This detail mattered only because it showed the conflict had started hours before the fatal encounter. It suggested rising tension, not a sudden, isolated moment. Detective Benton returned to the witness statements for a second pass. She wanted to know which details were most certain. The neighbor across the walkway was confident she heard fear in one of the voices. the neighbor with children believed he heard someone say, "Stop." The older resident believed he heard nothing until after the stabbing. These differences reflected the physical layout of the walkway. Thin walls, echoes, and the angle of each door created different layers of sound. Detectives knew that witness memory could shift under stress. They did not dismiss any statement, but they noted that none carried direct visual confirmation. In the afternoon, detectives brought in an audio technician to study the security footage's sound capture. The camera microphone did not provide conversation-level clarity. It picked up tone, volume, and sudden noises. The technician isolated the portion around 7:22 p.m. A faint voice rose above the background hum. It was too muffled to identify words. The technician confirmed that at least one voice sounded strained. The recording did not confirm aggression. It did not confirm compliance. It carried only the intensity of the exchange. Detectives next examined the suspect's apartment. The preliminary walkthrough had been completed the night before. A follow-up allowed them to observe signs of struggle. They did not find overturned furniture or broken items. They found no blood inside the suspect's living room or kitchen area. The absence of physical disturbance did not support the suspect's claim that the encounter began inside, but it did not completely rule it out without further testing. They collected samples from the doorway, the threshold, and the walkway immediately outside. By the end of the day, investigators had been forced into an uncomfortable position. They had physical evidence tied to the weapon and the victim. They had partial statements that conflicted. They had a timeline that contradicted parts of the suspect's account. They had a setting where tension was common and disputes flared quickly, but they did not have a clear sequence of events. Detective Benton summarized the status for her supervisor. She said that the case sat between two narratives. One narrative supported a sudden escalation that turned violent without warning. The other suggested an older conflict that boiled over. Neither narrative had enough evidence to stand without the other. She said they needed more work on the knife analysis, contact DNA, and the digital footprints from both men earlier in the day. Her supervisor agreed. He reminded her that the question was not only who struck the fatal blow. That part was clear. The deeper question was why it happened. Without that answer, the path toward charges would be difficult. The law required clarity that they did not yet have. As the day closed, detectives met once more with building management. They needed to know if any residents had complained about these two men specifically. Management confirmed that Thomas had filed two noise complaints in months past. They had no record of serious conflict between the two. They confirmed the suspect had a history of loud arguments that involved his own guests or phone calls. None of these incidents involved Thomas directly. Management also confirmed that the soundproofing in the building was poor. Raised voices carried easily. Many confrontations in the building escalated because people reacted to hearing sounds through thin walls rather than through face-to-face conversation. Detectives made detailed notes on the environment. They documented the narrow walkways, the blind angles of the building, the thin drywall, and the high-density layout. They noted how these physical elements shaped both the witness accounts and the nature of the conflict. Before leaving, Detective Benton reviewed the files once more. She knew the next steps depended on deeper analysis. The chapter of interviews was done. The chapter of lab results was beginning. The case now depended on whether those results would bring clarity or move the investigation deeper into uncertainty. As she closed her notebook, she asked herself the same question she had written that morning. Were they uncovering the truth, or were they stepping into a conflict shaped by fear, noise, and tension that had been building long before the final minutes in the walkway? The question remained open. Chapter 3. The Break in the Burden. Detective Laura Benton arrived at the station early the next morning. She placed her notes on the conference table and waited for the rest of the team. The case had shifted overnight. The loss of Thomas Hughes raised the stakes. The supervisors wanted a clearer direction before the end of the day. Benton knew that meant she needed something concrete, something that helped separate fact from fear. For now, she only had fragments. The forensic unit sent a message that they needed her in the lab. She walked down the hall and found two analysts waiting. On their workstation sat printouts, diagrams, and photographs from the previous night. The analysts explained that a new review of digital material had uncovered something important. A neighbor had recorded audio on his phone earlier that afternoon, hours before the fatal confrontation. He had used his phone to capture noise complaints for apartment management. The recording was short. It captured raised voices between two men near the parking lot. One voice belonged to Thomas, the other belonged to the suspect. The dispute was minor, but it showed a pattern. It was not proof of motive. It was simply evidence that the tension existed before the final encounter. Benton listened to the recording with full attention. It began with indistinct noise. Then Thomas's voice came through. He sounded frustrated but calm. He said he wanted the suspect to stop shouting on the phone in the early mornings. The suspect responded sharply, saying he would talk however he liked. The exchange lasted less than 30 seconds. There were no threats. There was no sign of physical aggression. It ended with footsteps moving away. Benton thanked the analysts. The audio mattered because it added context. It showed that the confrontation later that night had roots earlier in the day. It did not answer the central question of what happened at the doorway, but it shaped the understanding of the relationship between the two men. She added the details to her notes. Next, she met with officers preparing to execute a search warrant for the suspect's apartment. They had already done an initial walkthrough, but the warrant allowed for a deeper search, including examination of digital devices, clothing, and items near the doorway. Benton joined the team as they returned to the complex. The building manager met them in the parking lot and used his keys to open the main hallway. Inside the suspect's unit, officers moved carefully. They followed procedure, opening closets, drawers, and cabinets with measured steps. They photographed each section before touching anything. They collected multiple items of clothing that the suspect might have worn earlier in the day. They took swabs from the kitchen counter and sink. They examined the area near the doorway for signs of contact. They documented the distance between the kitchen, where the suspect said he grabbed a knife, and the front door, where the dispute allegedly occurred. Benton paid particular attention to the threshold. The detective from the forensic unit pointed to faint traces on the floor that could represent transfer patterns. They were not visible to the naked eye. The team collected samples for analysis. These details could help determine whether the confrontation moved inward or outward. Benton made careful notes. The doorway had become the center of the case. Everything depended on whether the fatal moment occurred, because Thomas stepped forward, the suspect stepped out, or both moved at the same time. When detectives finished the search, they returned to the station to begin sorting the evidence. Benton requested a meeting with the lead prosecutor assigned to the case. The prosecutor arrived with a thick case file and a reserved expression. The two sat in a quiet interview room and reviewed the known facts. Benton presented the timeline, the witness statements, the digital evidence, and the suspect's initial interview. The prosecutor asked pointed questions. Did any witness see Thomas strike the suspect? No. Did any witness hear Thomas issue a threat? No. Did any witness see the suspect retreat during the argument? Unclear. Did any witness see Thomas advance with force? Also unclear. The prosecutor underlined each uncertainty. He then asked about the knife. Benton explained that the suspect claimed he grabbed it because he feared harm. The prosecutor asked if there was any evidence supporting that claim. Benton said not yet. The prosecutor asked about the suspect's injuries. Benton confirmed that the suspect had no significant injuries. The prosecutor paused at that point. The absence of injuries complicated the self-defense claim but did not disprove it. Cases sometimes shifted on far less. The prosecutor then reviewed the digital recording from the afternoon. He said the dispute earlier that day showed tension but did not prove intent. He also said the recording did not show aggression from either man. It simply showed frustration. It was not enough to define the final confrontation. Benton asked what threshold they needed for charges. The prosecutor explained that the law required a clear picture of how the encounter escalated. Without direct witnesses, the case depended on physical evidence, patterns, and contradictions in statements. He said they needed to know whether the suspect's account matched the physical findings. If the patterns conflicted, that conflict could form the foundation of the case. The meeting lasted nearly an hour. When it ended, Benton returned to her desk and studied the photos from the walkway. She focused on the space between the suspect's door and the stairwell. She considered the blind angle that kept the camera from capturing the final moments. She wondered how quickly the dispute unfolded. The timeline showed that the confrontation lasted no more than 2 minutes. She knew that short conflicts often lacked clarity. People reacted before thinking. Witnesses recorded sound rather than sight. Evidence spread unevenly. These cases demanded patience. That afternoon, the forensic team delivered the first detailed analysis of the knife. The lab report stated that the blood on the blade belonged to Thomas. The handle had partial prints from the suspect. The edge of the blade carried transfer patterns that suggested movement toward Thomas rather than away. The report did not explain intent. It described only the mechanics. Benton added the findings to the file. The forensic team also analyzed the suspect's shirt. The blood on the front belonged to Thomas. The pattern suggested close contact. It did not show signs of defensive struggle. The forensic analyst explained that defensive struggle often left marks on both parties. In this case, there were no marks on the suspect that indicated he had been struck or grabbed. Benton noted the detail without drawing conclusions. She waited for more information. The next piece of evidence came from the doorway samples. The forensic team found traces of blood on the outer edge of the frame, not inside. The pattern suggested that contact occurred outside the apartment rather than within. This mattered because the suspect claimed that the confrontation began at the doorway and moved inward. The lack of interior transfer supported a different scenario. Benton documented the findings and prepared to confront the suspect with the new information. Before she did, she reviewed his first interview again. She listened to the tone of his voice. She listened to the certainty in his answers. She listened to the gaps. She then listened again to witness statements. She wanted to be sure she understood the context before asking new questions. When detectives entered the holding room, the suspect looked up without surprise. Benton introduced herself again and explained that new evidence had been processed. She told him this interview would also be recorded. He nodded and folded his hands. She began gently. She asked if he had anything to add to his earlier statement. He said no. She asked him to walk through the events again. His account matched his previous version. He said Thomas stepped forward. He said he feared harm. He said he acted to protect himself. When Benton asked why he armed himself before knowing whether Thomas intended violence, he said he acted on instinct. When she asked why the knife was found in the kitchen sink, he said he placed it there because he did not want anyone else to touch it. She asked about the distance from the doorway to the sink. He hesitated before answering. She noted the hesitation. She asked again if Thomas had been armed. He said he did not see a weapon, but believed Thomas could have overpowered him. She asked why. He said Thomas was angry. She asked how he knew Thomas was angry. He said he saw it in his body language. Benton paused. She asked if he remembered shouting. He said he remembered raising his voice but did not remember specifics. When the interview ended, Benton returned to the lab to gather more results. The forensic team had finished analyzing phone data. They reviewed messages sent by both men earlier in the day. Thomas had sent a message to a coworker stating that he was tired of the noise in the building. The suspect had sent messages about unrelated frustrations, but none referenced Thomas. The digital review offered context but did not define the confrontation. Later that evening, the prosecutor asked Benton to meet once more. He sat with her in a quiet office and reviewed the updated evidence. He said the doorframe transfers were significant. He said the shirt pattern was significant. He said the lack of injuries on the suspect raised concerns about the accuracy of the self-defense claim. But he also said that none of these details alone created a definitive picture. They formed part of a larger set of questions. He asked if any resident had a clear view of the stabbing. Benton said no. He asked if any camera captured the moment. She said no. He asked if any digital evidence proved intent. She said no. He leaned back and stared at his notes. He said the decision would not be simple. In the days that followed, the community at the apartment complex reacted in different ways. Some residents blamed the layout of the building for creating tension. Others blamed thin walls and poor soundproofing. Some blamed a lack of management response to noise complaints. A few said the tragedy was the result of two men who never found a way to communicate before the situation escalated. These opinions were not evidence. They were reflections of fear and frustration. Thomas's family visited the station during the week. They asked for answers. They asked how the confrontation started. They asked why it escalated. They asked whether anyone tried to help. Benton explained everything she could. She explained the timeline. She explained the evidence. She explained the uncertainties. The family thanked her, but left with the same question. Why did it happen? Benton could not answer. Not yet. The final decision came at the end of the week. The prosecutor filed charges based on the evidence available. The charges reflected the uncertainties. They acknowledged the lack of clear visual confirmation, but pointed to contradictions between the suspect's account and the physical findings. They noted the outward transfer patterns at the doorframe. They noted the lack of defensive wounds. They noted the inconsistencies in the suspect's description of the confrontation. The case moved into the court process. The suspect's defense team argued that he acted out of fear. They argued that the physical evidence could be interpreted multiple ways. They argued that the absence of direct witnesses left room for doubt. They prepared to challenge every detail. The community watched as the case progressed. Some felt relieved that charges were filed. Others felt uncertain because so much remained unclear. A few residents said they no longer felt safe in the building. Management promised to improve security. They promised to reinforce walls and improve camera coverage. They promised to address noise complaints more quickly. None of these actions changed the outcome for Thomas. The family held a memorial in his honor. Residents attended quietly. They shared stories about him. They talked about the way he greeted people in the hallway. They talked about his work ethic. They talked about the suddenness of his loss. Detective Benton attended the memorial. She stood at a distance and watched the family gather. She knew the investigation had reached its final stage, but she also knew that the unanswered questions would linger. The case had been shaped by incomplete views, thin walls, blind angles, muffled sounds, and human fear. It had been shaped by a building where people lived close together but knew little about each other. When she returned to the station that night, she closed her file and wrote the final note. It said that the investigation had clarified what it could. It said that the evidence supported the charges. It also said that some questions might never be fully answered. At the bottom of the page, she wrote one line. The truth of the final moments rests in a space no camera saw. She closed the file, turned off the lights, and left the room. The case moved into the next phase, carried by evidence, examination, and debate. But the hallway where it began remained marked by silence and uncertainty, a reminder of how quickly tension can rise in a crowded building and how difficult it can be to uncover the full truth when fear, noise, and unanswered questions shape every moment.